When we met last time and started our discussion on the present series on the yoga of knowledge, we discussed what is the object of our knowledge, the goal that we intend to reach by following the way of knowledge. And by the time we came to the end of our discussion, we were in the presence of the divine reality that ensouls all forms and movements, the eternal, on the bosom of which all moves in time, the immutable, on which all spatial formations move. We visualized the Self, which is the substratum of all forms in creation. We posited an omnipresent reality as the object of our knowledge. To reach this object, what is the means, the precise line of knowledge that we are to pursue, is the theme of our discussion this evening. Knowledge. When we talk of knowledge in common terms, it is understood to be the knowledge picked up by our outgoing senses, touching their objects, reporting back to the mind, and the mind's rendering into terms of the intellect. That is called knowledge. But this process of knowledge, the sense knowledge, touches only the surfaces of things, only the externals on which the senses impinge and report back. It does not go beyond the appearances. And as a consequence, we are obliged to revise the knowledge so arrived at as we touch in the course of life on different levels of life. What appears to be true on one surface, on the surface, is no more true when we probe a little deeper. It is why the mother calls the senses to be liars. Whether the senses grasp things as they are, even on the surface, is doubtful. Doubtful because each sense of the individual is directed by a motive, whether we are conscious of it or not. The motive of desire, the motive of ego, the motive of the thought. Each one wants knowledge to be in a particular bent, and the senses, consciously or unconsciously, obey that impulse and grasp things suitably. The knowledge of the senses is a biased knowledge. Obviously, this knowledge is out of question in the quest in which we are. Even the knowledge that is of a higher type than the sense knowledge, the knowledge that is obtained by the interpretation by the mind on the data brought by the senses, even that is doubtful. The mind interprets in a particular way. The same data presented to five different individuals would be interpreted in five different ways by their minds. The mind is interested in understanding things in a particular way. The mind is too interested to be an objective interpreter of knowledge or the data supplied to it. You may ask whether in that case all the knowledge on which we move is useless. Certainly not. The old Upanishads make a distinction between the higher knowledge and the lower knowledge. I had once recalled here, perhaps many of you were not there at that time, and it may be worthwhile repeating. It is recorded in one of the texts, at least 3,000 to 4,000 years old, that when Narada, the famous sage who had undergone several austerities, who had gone to the end of the knowledge that could be garnered through a study of sciences and arts, he realized that he had known only verbal knowledge and not the truth of things. He invoked the divine. He invoked the Son of God. It's called the Sanat Kumara, the eternal child, and appealed to him. I have studied, I have pulled over the 64 sciences that are sanctified in the name of God. But at the end of it all, I have realized that I know nothing. I know only the words and what the words say. I am not in the presence of the knowledge that is meaningful. And it is recorded that the grace in the form of the child of God took compassion and answered his prayer to show him the other shore beyond the darkness of ignorance. There he speaks of the lower knowledge and the higher knowledge. The lower knowledge consists of the various branches of learning, arts, sciences, as many as 64 of them. And he says, they do not help to reach the soul. It is only the higher knowledge that takes you beyond the forms and appearances, puts you in proximity of the One Self, the Eternal, where knowledge is got by means other than the mental. That is the higher knowledge and the true knowledge. But the Upanishad takes care to record that the lower knowledge is a necessary step to the higher one. These branches of learning, knowledge based upon the data of the senses, knowledge built up by the intellect, all of them give us the truth of the processes, at any rate, the certain processes in creation, the processes in which nature works. Maybe we are not yet given the processes of higher nature, but the intricate processes of the machinery of the lower nature, earth nature, these processes have been opened out and made familiar to our mind. Thus far, they have served humanity, and we record our gratitude to modern science, to older sciences, for the service that they have rendered in familiarizing man with the processes, the operations of truth. But when we want to know what is the truth of things, not the process in which it works, but what is the truth and why does it work that way, we are in another realm of consciousness. And to walk into this realm, to understand the mysteries of this realm, we need to cultivate other means of knowledge. The sense knowledge, the intellectual knowledge, they are to be left behind once their purpose is served, to sharpen the mind, to prepare the mind. Thereafter, they have to be left behind. Even the highest processes, the highest means of the traditional yoga of knowledge in the Indian tradition, those of deliberation and discrimination, they do not give us the truth. A traditional jnana yogin, who a practitioner of the yoga of knowledge of the Vedanta, he takes during his meditation or concentration or communion with God each form that comes before him, deliberates upon it. What is its nature? Why does it come? How does it come into being? Deliberates, discriminates it, discriminates its elements of temporal as against the eternal, discriminates the true from the false, rejects the untrue, rejects the temporal, and successively deliberation and discrimination is practiced by him. Till from his consciousness all that belongs to this temporal and transitory world is shed out. But in this process, in this yoga, the utmost purpose that is served by deliberation and discrimination is one of removing the cobwebs of ignorance, removing the darkness and obscurity, removing the obstructions. If I may say so, purifying negatively. But there, their rule ends. We have to build upon the land, upon the ground that has been cleared by this twin operation of deliberation and discrimination. After the full operation of the sharp intellect has cleared the ground, has rejected the impressions heaped by the senses, analyzed and collated by the intellect in its own way, there comes the operation, the spiritual operation of vision. One may have intellectualized, read, heard from others, and formed certain definite idea of what the reality is, of what the self is. I may say, and my mind may be convinced that the reality is one, that the reality is immutable and eternal. But there it stops. It is a mental idea a mental knowledge which does not have a concrete impact on the rest of my being? Does it change my movements in life? Does it really affect my attitude to men and things? An intellectual conviction, how far does it carry man? What the mind is convinced of, the intellect has built at its level, it can have its full power only when one has the direct vision of the reality. Just as on the physical plane, we hear of so many things, we form ideas from books, from reports, from imagination, but we get the full value only when you see by the direct sight. When the thing is presented to our physical vision, we get an idea. We form a contact, and that becomes part of us. Thereafter, for the rest of our lives, it remains with us. Similarly, on the spiritual plane, on the satellite plane, unless one has or one is vouchsafed the vision of the reality, the divine as light, you have a representation, a direct light ray of the divine falling on you and making a concrete impact, the knowledge has not yet become real. But even this vision, the vision of light, the vision of form, is only the first touch. The eye that sees is not the whole being. Man consists of so many parts of himself, and each part of myself has to realize its truth in the self. The self projects itself in the form of mind, in the form of the heart, in the form of the life force, in the form even of the body. Each formation, each formulation has got to go back to its indwelling inherent self and realize that truth. The mind has to realize the direct sense of its knowledge of the supreme reality, say for instance, as existence, consciousness and bliss. The heart has to go back and realize the truth of what it calls love, that it is not the changing human emotion that we call love, but it is the unchanging, independent truth called love that pours on all irrespective of the reactions or recognitions. Similarly, the life force has to realize its truth in the self as a projection of the consciousness force of the divine. Even the physical learns in the course of tapasya how it is not a veil, but an embodiment of the physical self. Now all this, at each level of the being, the revelation that has started with the vision has to be built up. This is called experience. Vision followed by experience. Experience gives us a touch of the reality. The experience, but that is not the end. So many spiritual careers have come to an end, untimely end, simply because The people concerned mistook one experience to be the total realization. Experience is one point of contact. Each experience has to be confirmed repeatedly, organized, established in the being, and built into a realization. Experience is the seed out of which the fruit of realization has to emerge. And when this experience of the reality through is confirmed repeatedly by evocation, by opening of oneself and organized in the rest of the being, there comes the stage of identity, identity with the divine. When there is the identity, there is no knower. One becomes one with the known. The trinity of the knower, the known, and the knowledge fuse into one. There is a complete realization of the reality. This passage, however, from the human level to the divine is long. It has to proceed through many stages, but largely this process, this passage is twofold. That part which constitutes purification of the members of our being, and as a consequence the part that constitutes the illumination of the being by the higher consciousness towards which we move. Unless each part of ourselves, or to begin with the leading part, is purified of the dross of lower nature, of its ignorance, remnants of falsehood, egoism, unless the part that leads and thereafter the parts that follow are subjected to a radical process of purification, it is idle to expect that progress is made. As purification proceeds, the higher consciousness responds by throwing its rays of light, peace and joy to strengthen the members that are being purified. Thus, there is no clear demarcation between the two processes of purification and illumination. They really go side by side. As purification proceeds, there is a larger opening affected where the illumining rays of the higher consciousness are received, and as the rays act upon the levels that are cleared, the area is extended, resistances in related regions break down, and more parts get purified. In man, the leading part, particularly in the yoga of knowledge that we are at present considering, is understanding. It is imperative that the understanding of things, the understanding that has to lead us in the path ahead, has to be purified. Unless this understanding is purified, one is likely very much to be confused, to be misled. With all good intentions, one can be misled. Sri Aurobindo, he has written in a letter which was published in the Riddle of the World called The Intermediate Zone. I do not remember in which volume precisely of the letters on yoga it has been included, where he describes the 100 ways in which the mind can be dazzled, the understanding can be confused, and one may get lost completely in the zone of dazzling splendors, pleasing falsehoods. The understanding has to be purified. Why does the understanding need to be purified? As we have discussed, the mind itself, which is our instrument of knowledge, consists broadly of three layers. First, with which an average man starts, is the sense mind, the mind based upon senses. That we know is full of impurities, unreliable evidences. Second, that part of the intellect which bases itself entirely on the report of the sense mind. It interprets them. It builds knowledge based upon evident senses. Third is what is called the reason proper, which analyzes cold-blooded logic and pretends to give complete knowledge, foolproof knowledge. But we know reason is a very good understudy, but never a reliable master. Reason can support or contradict any proposition. It depends upon what you want it to do. And here is the danger. No operation of human intellect, the human mind, thinking mind, is free from mixture, the intermissions of desire. Sri Aurobindo has written pages after pages describing how the undercurrent of desire inclines the reason, inclines the logical mind to interpret things, to understand things in a particular way, to suit the fulfillment of desire. That desire again need not be the vital kind of desire for vital fulfillment as we think it. It can be very much a mental desire, a spiritual desire, to arrive at ideas and notions which we want, which we are fond of, to extol and exaggerate certain realizations which are dear to us and deprecate others. This is the manifold desire that twists the operations of the intellect at its very source. What Sri Aurobindo calls the impurity of will. The will is involved in an interested operation. That contributes to the defective and faulty working of the understanding. Second, by habit, the process has been built up of feeding the understanding from the sense level. That again brings another element of impurity. Third, there is, just as I mentioned now, the element of impurity in thought itself. We have each one of us pet ideas, pet notions, want truth to be a particular way, want it to present itself in this manner or that form. This prejudges the issue, and the understanding is weighed in favor of our recognized or unrecognized notions and preferences. These are the three impurities that are to be eliminated from our understanding. It is only then, Sri Aurobindo points out, that understanding comes into its own form, where it ceases to be an understanding but becomes an overstanding, standing above the movement and observing the truth in them, the truth behind them. When the understanding is so purified, rarefied, it is to be subjected to a twofold passivity. It recognizes that the true knowledge, is not to come from outside, but from within, from the heights of the being, above it, behind it. The understanding realizes that there are levels of knowledge waiting to be tapped. They pour themselves through the levels of intuition, revelation. All the knowledge that is required, the knowledge of all that goes on, has gone on and used to go on, is preserved at a level of knowledge where what is called even the memory of the future is stored. If the prepared understanding falls silent and awaits this revelation with a vigilance and a keenness, the contents pour themselves. But that is not the end. The formulations of the reality in terms of knowledge are poured into the upturned understanding that is purified. There is also, when the thought mind is in this process of purifying the understanding, silenced, when the mind is shorn of these disturbing mechanical thought movements, and just it falls silent like the waters of a lake described by Patanjali, the ancient systematizer of yoga. When the layers of the thought mind silent, nothing moves, then the reality reflects itself in its pure form. In silence, one hears the silence. One can hear the silence. In peace, the understanding dawns. Here, this is a typical example of the confusion in understanding. The reality, the supreme reality, is above time and space. It is unchanging, immutable, You can't describe it as this or that. It is there. It is the manifestation of that truth that proceeds in terms of time and space. Even time and space are its own formulations. Time is the divine, the eternal as duration. Space, the infinite as extension. Now, it is this manifestation of the reality that is dynamic, changing, bringing out new contents out of the bosom of reality, moment to moment, age to age. And it is these truths, these aspects of the reality that reveal themselves, that are realized by man. There is no end to the aspects of the divine reality that can be realized by man. But on that account, there is no comparison by way of superiority or inferiority, limited or unlimited. Each spiritual realization, each realization of one front of the reality is valid, supremely valid. The manifestation goes on, but the highest reality at the moment in time or available to human consciousness, that is called the supreme attainable reality. In the ancient Indian tradition, the highest attainable level of the reality was called Shiva, Brahman. But they were careful to posit, beyond that, there is something which we cannot say what it is not. And realize what? When you come to the realizable summit, you become one with it. There is nothing further, nobody to realize thereafter. Whether each avatar, he came to realize in human form, embody in human form, and make available to humanity the particular grade of truth, the particular potential of truth, which was necessary at that stage in their evolution. Necessarily, in terms of time, each successive avatar brings a fuller truth in keeping with the more advanced stage of evolution of humanity. Sri Aurobindo has arrived at a time when humanity is ready for a more synthetic, a more rounded realization of the reality than was possible before. All the realizations brought down and manifested by all the great figures have been so many contributions leading to this fulfillment of the present age. Nobody ever said that this is the final. Sri Aurobindo himself says, once you realize the supramental realization, have come to the supramental realization, and how is the supramental consciousness? There are still further vistas. New avatars may come. New, we may not call them avatars at that time, but new manifestations will come. The vistas of the infinite are endless. There is no limit. We can't say this is the highest and no further. What is the highest possible now for human consciousness? That is with which we are concerned. The rest is only academic. It is very interesting. This was precisely almost the same question that was put to me this morning. Somebody asked, said that you have written in one of your writings that one must refer to the psychic within each movement in day-to-day life. How is it to be done? This was the question that I was asked this morning, and I answered in a way. Now this question from this friend is, where does the psychic come in the practice of deliberation and discrimination with a view to purifying one's understanding? Where does the guidance of Sri Aurobindo and Mother come in? Now, done purely as a mental operation, this process of deliberation and discrimination is a laborious process. It is called Vichara Marga, the way of inquiry, the way of mental scrutiny in the Indian tradition. Very laborious. People spend hours together analyzing whether this is true, not true, the black is black, or it is a shade of white. Or they go on inquiring and lose themselves in rounds of speculation. It becomes a very dry process, and one is apt to become a prisoner of the process that is intended to liberate the mind. So, to prevent this mental process of deliberation and discrimination from becoming a laborious and self-defeating project, one has to call in the aid of the psychic. The psychic, after all, what is the psychic? Psychic center is the point where the divine presence in each person stations itself. Whether you are aware of it or not, whether you take cognizance of it or not, it is there. The presence is there. One has to have first the faith that the divine presence is there in the core of the heart. One doesn't have that knowledge immediately when you start on the path. So, you have to take the word of those who have gone before you and have that faith. Yes, there is a divine presence. Having that faith, you must, in moments of your meditation, concentration or prayer, have an aspiration and call the divine there to reveal itself. Exert that pressure on the divine intensely during periods of meditation. In a general way, have that remembrance and that aspiration during the rest of the time, that it should reveal itself. If you have a sincere desire to have that presence manifest in you, gradually an awareness develops in you of something that is behind all this movement, separate, uninvolved. You have to fix your consciousness there. You have found a point. Thereafter, by dwelling upon it, by paying attention to it, you have again to extend that area. Gradually, there is an articulate response to your aspiration. We need not go into the further processes. So every time, once that happens, or till that happens with the minimum of faith, every time there is a contact with somebody, with some movement, whether you seek for it or you don't seek and it is just impinges itself upon you, before you react, step back and remember. There is no need to call it to guide you. Remember the divine vision. You will be guided. Similarly, when you are about to act, little, small or big, anywhere, remember. And the center of reference develops. Your center of reference in life moves from the external mind to the soul, to the psychic. This is the philosophy. But most of us, all of us here, are so favorably circumstanced that we do not need to imagine, to conceive the divine or the psychic in the abstract. We have the mother who links us with the reality within ourselves, within others, outside, everywhere. She embodies the divinity for us. Remember, mother, every time you act, every time you react, you remember the mother. This builds up the mother's consciousness slowly, step by step, dynamically in you, and it becomes a force. As her consciousness develops from being merely a center of reference, the charge of the sadhana is taken away from your hands. Deliberation, discrimination, they will proceed spontaneously from that consciousness. Sri Aurobindo and the mother are dynamic presences in action in each one of us. We have only to remember and evoke. The guidance is there. After evoking, to follow it up is our part. And it is there that most fail. Sincerity, purity, receptivity, these are demanded. When one knows that this is the true thing, still one persists for any reason in doing a different thing. The guidance will not repeat itself if this continues for more than two or three times. Sincerity, that is the first step. Receptivity, vigilance. When the guidance comes, one has to act upon it without question.
With grace, I mean, with a sincere aspiration for grace,
one can certainly, certainly. Actually, as the mother says, if you take one step, the divine takes two steps. It withdraws, but it doesn't go back. It waits. The moment you realize that I have done a mistake, it is enough. It comes. It gives you another chance. Whether you will act, it gives many chances, even the slightest realization that yes, I have done, I have not followed, it is enough. That is an implicit admission and a readiness to correct oneself, still by sheer weakness. Now here again, there are two things to be kept in mind. One doesn't follow the guidance by sheer weakness. And one knows that one is false. One is at fault, I have not followed. He repents. He is still in the action of the grace. But one cheats himself. He is cunning. His cunning vital comes, justifies, and he deliberately misinterprets the guidance and does something else. Now that is what the mother calls spiritual suicide. Even grace can't do anything there. If a man deliberately, knowingly cheats himself and twists the guidance, if one does out of ignorance, if one does out of weakness, there is scope for redemption. Grace is there. even for him who rejects the grace acts, but in a different way. It acts through the operation of karma. For him, the grace saves. For the other, the grace acts through the compulsions of karma. Yes. Usually, the ethical, the traditional, the moral guidance, injunctions, they are sediments left in the mental and vital levels out of an inherited past or a present in which we live. But the psychic level is deeper. When the psychic guidance is there, there is a feeling of conviction. It doesn't admit of any yes or no. It is transparent. It does not impose itself. It does not compel you to obey. But there it is. It shows itself. There is about it an atmosphere of certainty. A soft peace, a velvety background to that guidance. If you do not accept, it just goes back. It does not compel you to obey it. It carries a conviction about it. One has to be silent. One has, if one is not satisfied, mentally analyze whether this is comes from the spiritual depths or from my own mental understanding of what is right, what is ethical, what is moral. If one is sincere and submits the problem to the divine within or above, and just waits for a moment without struggling to get the reply, one gets it. Mother has said that people, they are restless. They want the answer, they want the answer. And they give their own answer thereafter. One has to wait in trust. At times, it is good to forget about it. After submitting the problem, to forget about it for a while. When you least expect it, it sails into the being, it sails into the mind. This is the answer. The mind, the veil of the mind has to be removed. One has to submit trustfully and wait. One may say that a busy man in the street does not have all this time to do. But all this operation is not expected of him. It is expected of a seeker. And the seeker has all the time. A person outside in the world who is seeker within, he has time within.
As the opening.
Usually, these visions, these revelations, in form, either form of light or in form of particular, you know, figures. They do not come by our effort. They just reveal themselves when the consciousness is ready to receive them. Now, to make the consciousness ready, receptive, to bring it into a fit condition, when it can watch, when it can receive the impact, all these methods, concentration, a gathering meditation, movement of rising prayer, a silent lapse of the consciousness. These are the methods in which the conditions is prepared for the revelation to take place. By whatever means, the outspread consciousness has to be gathered and presented like this. This thing can happen even involuntarily in certain cases. Say, in a moment of crisis, there is an accident, something happens on the battlefield, or some emergency. Suddenly, all the outer coverings fall away and the inner consciousness gathers up without our effort. These are the moments that the Divine waits to reveal itself. It can happen involuntarily also. It can happen when you least expect it, when the soul pushes forward. When you least, you may be in the midst of work in a factory. One has the vision. Not a mental vision, but a spiritual vision. The soul in its inner evolution, which goes on irrespective of what you do or do not do, if a moment has arrived for it to take a leap, and all the outer senses are dulled, inner eye, the inner senses come forward and take cognizance. You think that you have heard it and seen it from the physical eye. So these are the various possibilities open to man. But for a seeker, he has to make the effort on his side to keep himself in a constant state of readiness for any message that may come, for any revelation that may be shown to him, for any word that may reach him through anyone or through none.